Welcome to another segment of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today we'll be joined by our very special guest, Todd Stevens. Todd is probably best known for writing and directing such movies as Edge of 17, Gypsy 83, another gay movie, and the recently released Swan Song. Well, welcome to the show, Todd.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you about some of these fabulous bars from your gay history going back to the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
As the world probably knows, you kind of memorialized at least one of them in one of your first gay movies called The Edge of 17, which was a fabulous movie. I was so excited when it came out that there was a movie out there that just kind of embraced the coming out experience in a small town America and had a realistic feel to it, which I understand is because it was about you.
Yeah, that character was me. Eric Hunter was the character's name, but really it was Todd Stevens, or inspired by my life. Yeah, so I grew up in that town, and that bar was really interesting because it was unlike a lot of queer bars that I think are more hidden. It was very much in plain sight. We had a big giant amusement park that's very famous and fabulous called Cedar Point. And the Fruit and Nut, as we called it, was right near the Cedar Point entrance, like on a really busy road. And that was really cool, you know. But I would start to kind of, spend a few moments driving through the parking lot. You know, I scoped it out, trying to get the courage to go in, and that took me a while. But I hope I captured that excitement in Edge of 17 of, like, you know, going home to the queer bar for the first time.
Yeah, it was really quite a cool story. And when did you actually write the movie?
In the mid 90s, I think, maybe 96. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, 95, somewhere in that.
About 10 years after it actually happened.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You were kind of reminiscing about your coming out experiences in Sandusky, Ohio.
Yeah.
And thought, hey, this will make a movie.
Yeah, I always kind of knew that I had like a coming out story to tell that I wanted to tell. And I was trying to, after I graduated from NYU, I thought I would write horror movies. But, I decided to write what I knew, as my professors had encouraged me to do. And kind of laid my own personal story out there.
So when you went into the Fruit and Nut for the first time, what was it like in there? Was it really, you know, the bar in the movie is a rather large bar with, you know, a lot of personality and some really interesting characters in there. Was that really what the bar was like in Sandusky?
It was, yeah. I mean, the exterior of the bar still exists, became like a junior achievement, which is what it is now. But, even back then, the interior had been gutted. The bar was, it's a really interesting asymmetrical building. It was like a mid-century modern cocktail lounge. It was built in the late 50s or early 60s. It was originally called the Surf Lounge, and it had like a nautical theme, you know. So when you walked in, it was large. There was the place was very famous for its like amoeba shaped bar. It wasn't a circle, but it was like an amoeba. So that was kind of like directly there when you walked in, and then to the left was the dance floor, which was part of it was like raised up, and there were a bunch of mirrors behind it, and banquettes kind of surrounding, and like tables, like cocktail tables surrounding the dance floor. So I think back in the day, they used to have like lounge acts and stuff perform there. So it was all centered on kind of like gravitating to that stage area, which obviously was the dance floor and then used in drag shows. But It was very popular. I mean, it was, I first went there in December of 1984, right after it first opened. And you know, one thing I remember, on the door was a sign, that said, the Universal Fruit and Nut Company is a gay establishment, but all are welcome. So that was really the spirit of the place. It was very diverse. You know, my community where I grew up is a third black. So it was a black and white and old and young and male and female and straight and gay. It was like a melting pot of all the fabulous and the freaks and the queerness of the whole surrounding area, much of which was like countryside. You know, it's like, it's where all the cool people found each other.
Right. And I know from my research that I've done that in your movies, generally speaking, you try to cast gay actors in the gay character roles. Was that true in that movie? Did you pretty much choose to pick people who identified as gay or
not then? I mean, it was a different mentality then. I mean, you know, this conversation about queer representation and stuff, didn't really exist so much back then. That conversation, I mean, you know, it was hard to find actors to play gay parts, period, whether they're gay or straight. Right. So you were just trying to find the best actor that you could for the part. A couple actors I cast in my films, I didn't even know they were gay at the time. And then they kind of came out later.
Of course, so, Leah Delaria, you knew about.
Oh, yeah. Leah, I knew about. Yeah. Yeah. That was no secret. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she's been quite open about her gayness for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. Big, big idol of mine. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in that movie, you filmed the Universal Fruit and Nut Company, and you had this big splashy logo on the outside of the building. But That was not the actual logo for the bar, correct?
That's right. Yeah, that the logo was more this hand-drawn logo. Which I've used in Swan Song, you know, as the basis for the sign. But yeah, it's the art department just thought that that the other one was more, you know, splashy, as you say, or whatever. I preferred the original logo, but yeah. So the exterior was filmed in the actual Fruit and Nut, and there was a parking lot scene where, you know, there's a lot of action in the parking lot.
Yes,
in real life and in my life, that I tried to reflect in the film. And but the interior, like I said, had changed. All of the bar and everything had been removed. So we wound up shooting the interior at a bar called Legends on Detroit Road in Lakewood in Cleveland, which is about an hour away. And it had a very fruit and nut feel, like a very warm. It was also drag-centric bar, and so that really was a good substitution for the Fruit and Nut. You know, I would have liked to have shot the interior and the real Fruit and Nut, but it didn't exist anymore. You know,
right.
So yeah.
Now you focus your movies, at least three of them, in kind of a trilogy that took like 20 years to complete. The second in the series about Sandusky is Gypsy 83. And that one doesn't really address gay bars so much as kind of outsider personalities, but it's a great movie. And it also addresses a little bit of evolution in the scene from Sandusky, how it changed from, you know, how it was in the Fruit and Nut days moving forward. What kind of inspired that movie?
Gypsy? That was, you know, it was still, that movie was a lot about wanting to get out, you know, wanting to escape where you grew up. And the main character, Gypsy, was like at a point in her life, either she was going to stay there forever or she was going to leave. And kind of inspired by her queer younger best friend, they they ran away from home and, you know, went to Night of a Thousand Stevies, which is a real life event by a bar in the city called, well, it was a bar at the time called Mother. But it's still a event. It's been going on for close to 30 years now, where once a night, everybody dresses up as Stevie Nicks and performs, and it's really wonderful. So Stevie Nicks is a huge influence of mine, as you could see from the fact that I literally stole her song title to be the name of my first movie. That was kind of about trying to get away, you know, to finding out where, who, you know, trying to figure out who you were, accepting yourself as who you were. And I think that they felt like they needed to run away in order to do that in that film.
And that was kind of a big theme in real gay life for the 80s and 90s anyway, because especially if you were from a small town, it was difficult to be what is now labeled your authentic self when you were living in a conservative small town that did not have a big gay lifestyle. And you wanted to explore who you really were and be the person that you felt like you were on the inside.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of us had to run away in order to figure out who we were. That's true. Yeah.
And so then you took a little bit of a break, I guess, from the Sandusky scene, and you had another gay movie, which was a completely different look at gay life than, you know, than Edge of 17 was. Where did that come from?
Interestingly enough, that came from like being angry and hurt that Gypsy 83, like my first film, Edge of 17, we didn't even know what we were doing. And it wound up being really connecting and getting into Sundance and getting a great distributor and kind of ultimately being like a, you know, independent hit film. And then Gypsy 83, like I almost kind of had the same expectations, and I was still trying to expand out of just like a queer market. And, you know, that film was about a straight ally, female ally, and her relationship with her gay best friend, which was very intimate. And, you know, they were besties for, and, you know, a lot of us gay men can relate to that. But at the time, people, the distributors and stuff, like, said that the movie wasn't gay enough. And that because it was about a woman, a straight woman and a queer man, that it wasn't gay enough, and they didn't know what the movie poster was. And, you know, back then, you know, gay content was pretty much just sold to gay people. And you really, the distributors felt you needed like hot shirtless men kissing on the poster or whatever to reach their market. That film, oh, here it is right here. That's the DVD of it. But they didn't know, you know, they felt that image, you know, what was not as marketable then. It's very different now, 20 years later. So I was pissed off, you know. I was like, that wasn't gay enough. Okay, bitch. Like, I'm going to make the gayest movie ever made. And basically, you know, Flippy the Bird and Rebel and very John Waters inspired, who's like one of my idols. And another gay movie is almost like a movie where I thought of the movie poster before I even made the film. But within doing that, like I wanted to have a moment when we as queer people could laugh at ourselves and have a stupid, gross out teen sex comedy just like straight people do, and just like I grew up with Porky's and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and, you know, Risky Business and all those films. And why can't gay people have a gay American pie, you know? So even though on the surface it's like sort of ridiculous, like I was trying to kind of push buttons with it and have a moment where we could not take ourselves so seriously and be able to laugh at ourselves. You know, I really made that film for the queer audience, for us. And but it was actually inspired out of like hurt and anger, which I think a lot of comedy stuff is oftentimes.
So with the success of Edge of 17 and the success of Another Gay Movie, did that pretty much cement your position in the world of making gay movies? Was that pretty much the decision at that point that there's not going to be a horror movie or a thriller? It's pretty much going to be gay from now on.
All gay all the time. I don't know. I don't know that that's been such a conscious like choice. It's just that that's what I want to talk about. You know, like, I feel like now that I look back at my movies, like I'm like commenting on gay life, you know, and how it's evolved over the years. And I guess that's just my passion, you know. I think that's just kind of my agenda, you know, and not that I wouldn't make films that were non-queer, but that's really what excites me, you know, and write what you know, you know. So that's, yeah, I'm fine to make queer films for the rest of my life.
Well, and it's getting to be quite a genre now. I mean, there's a number of people who have come out of the woodwork and have made multiple gay theme movies that are very recognizable and well known, particularly in the gay community. And it's become so not so much of a fringe topic anymore.
Right.
But you, of course, are rooted in a history of doing it for much longer than a lot of other people have, as well as actually living the life that goes with it. You know, you're not an outsider. You're not Steven Spielberg trying to imagine what it's like to be a gay teenager. You live through it, and you have the stories to tell from your own personal experiences and the experiences of many of the people you've interacted with.
Yeah, and I mean, this is another whole interesting debate, but I almost feel like these are our stories to tell, not Steven Spielberg's.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't know. I just think that we lived it. And so, and, you know, it's not my story really to tell to make a transgender protagonist, because that's not... So a transgender writer director should do that. Yeah, I mean, it's just more authentic when it comes out of our own actual representation and experience, I think. I don't know. People have different attitudes about that, you know? So it's like an interesting question, but I feel like now over the years, it's like, you know, people, I don't know. We're you know, more authentic filmmakers are more making things, you know, and so that I think that that's a really good thing.
Now, in Edge of 17, you chose to focus on the Universal Fruit and Nut Company as kind of a big, important part of your life. And we obviously know that that was, you know, where you came out, where you went to a gay bar for the first time. But what a lot of people haven't really, I don't think, heard about or talked about is the fact that it also had an impact on your life to this very day. You have an important part of your life that actually came out of that very bar, correct?
Yes, my husband. my husband, Tim, was sitting at that bar that I told you about in 1985. And he had bleach blonde kind of, you know, Depeche Mode hair. And he had like a long tail, like, you know, those rat tails. Like,
right.
I thought he was so hot. And I kind of got in there illegally. I mean, I was 17 and, you know, back in the day, it was like, whatever. But you know, he was a few years older, although I lied and told him I was 18. But I went and pulled on his tail and I said, "Nice tail," you know. So yeah, that was in, you could do the math, that was in 1985, and we've been together ever since. So I met my husband at the Fruit and Nut, and lifelong friends as well, you know. And it like so many queer spaces in small towns, it was a family, you know.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And it was a tight family. I mean, and just to digress for a second, it's like I did a lot of research about the queer history of my hometown, which is not a very big town. It's about 30 or 40,000 people. And, you know, even before I learned that, that there was a place called the, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the name. I'll think of it in a minute, but, like a hotel downtown where, you know, that was kind of like the queer space, but wasn't officially queer. There was like a female bartender who would like, you know, turn the other cheek, turn away to for, let the guys dance for 5 minutes or whatever. Oh my God, why can't I remember it? I'll figure it out later. I'm just blanking on the name of it, but it's like, that was like the unofficial gay bar in town going back to the '50s and sixties. You know, even my hometown had, being small, it had like a rich gay history. And, by the time Tim and Mike like founded the first queer bar, which was called The Keg in 1977, the community was a real family. And I hear these stories about these rolling dinner parties, you know, where they would start at one person's house for appetizers and next for cocktails and then the main course and dessert. I'm sure there was a bit of drunk driving involved, unfortunately. But you know, of pig roasts and drag shows in barns in the country, and they were family, you know. I mean, in part because they had to be, you know. But so when I'm jumping around a bit, but like when I did the research for Mr. Pat and Swan Song, you know, I really talked to a lot of the old timers from the communities, the one from the community that are still alive. Many died of AIDS in my hometown, even though it was small. But yeah, I mean, it was a family, you know. And we could talk more about this later or whatever, but we all know that those spaces are many of them are disappearing and endangered, and that family is kind of melted or assimilated, you know, back into the world, which in a way is amazing, but on the other hand, it's a loss of a culture almost.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the course of this project, and it's still ongoing, I'm still learning things about new bars or old bars that no longer exist every day. But I've cataloged over 1,500 gay bars across the U.S. that at one time played an important part in somebody's life and have just vanished from the scene. But even more significantly, I think, in some of the cities that I've particularly been personally familiar with, for instance, Atlanta, at the time that you were experiencing the Sandusky scene in the mid-80s, I had just recently moved to Atlanta by that time. And Atlanta at that time, I think, had 30 or 35 gay or gay-accepting bars at one time. And people would frequently feel like it was a sense of community. You would go to multiple bars in one night. It wasn't necessarily you had one choice and you stayed there for 6 hours. You went out many nights of the week, even work nights, you would go out for a drink or two or just to socialize because you couldn't really do that in public. You know, you were at risk of losing your job, at risk of, you know, being arrested for illegal or immoral activity. You were possibly going to be disowned by your family if you were still near home. So the bars became our community centers. They became, and they were the driving force between, you know, the community and all of these organizations that we now take for granted. You know, organizations like GLAAD or the National LGBT Task Force, they would not exist if the bars and the drag queens were not there to support them and to, you know, get the community together. And
absolutely. Yeah. Hallelujah. That's true. Absolutely.
And I think you encapsulated that concept perfectly in the most recent movie that you did, which has been getting incredible reviews from everybody I know that's seen it, from everywhere I've seen online, every review and article about it, Swan Song, which takes you back to Sandusky, some 25 years after, I guess you wrote Edge of 17. I mean, it's quite a while. Yeah. Goes back to Sandusky and looks at it from the opposite end of the spectrum, from a senior citizen who is in a home and had a colorful history with Sandusky's nightlife in his youth, and breaks out of this facility, walks, I don't know how many miles, down to the center of town, and re-experiences some of the gayborhood that he had been exposed to before. And I think Udo played an incredible role. I mean, that character was so rich and so believable. It was just amazing.
Thank you.
And yeah. You're quite welcome. I mean,
Thank you for saying all that.
And as I mentioned to you on our phone conversation, I was just floored when he's sitting in the bar and in his German accent says, you know, when all the bars close, where will we dance?
Right.
And that brought me right back to what I just said about these being our community centers and the, you know, the focal point of our gay lives. Is that something that I know you had planned to write a third part of that Sandusky story, probably from the beginning, sounds like. Did you ever know that's where it was going to go?
No, I didn't. I thought it was going to be like something else, but no. But, you know, as I started noticing a number of years ago that, you know, queer spaces were not just bars, but hotels. I mean, there used to be these gay hotels in Puerto Rico that I used to go to, like, or there may be some left, but most of them are gone, you know, like gay B&Bs. I used to have this like book of like gay B&Bs, you know, and all of these places of like, I don't know. They're just all disappearing. And so at some point I noticed that and was happening. And I wanted to spark a conversation about, you know, this older, senior, you know, elder, you know, that kind of going back looking for his gay world and realizing that it had completely changed and that it was like either gone or had evolved into something else that he really didn't even recognize. In doing that, I chose to have it be, he goes back to the fruit and nut on the last night of its existence and kind of helps it go out with a bang without giving too much away. But I really, you know, saw the film as not just the swan song to the character's life, but the swan song to gay culture in a way, you know, or the gay experience that not just my generation or maybe we're a similar generation or, you know, but my generation, the generations before me and maybe even a little after me that we knew of as gay life is almost kind of coming to an end. Is that true? I don't know. It's like, I hate to even say that, and it's not totally true, but I almost want to provoke like that conversation. Like, is that okay for a lot of these places are going away?
Yeah. And
that was a big part of what I wanted to, you know, the vanishing gay culture. And I found that it's straight people, you know, have no idea that was happening. And they were very fascinated with that idea. You know, wow, gay bars are closing. I didn't know that. You know, it's like, so I just tried to like, you know, educate some extent with the film, which is what I think a lot of times we try to do as filmmakers.
Yeah, it was an incredible movie.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the experience and, you know, learning from you that it actually even had a little bit more, paid a little bit of homage to the gay bar scene in Sandusky in another way. You, the original Fruit and Nut from Edge of 17 was filmed at the original exterior of
right.
the Fruit and Nut,
mm-hmm.
which was out by the theme park. But because of the storyline in the new one, you kind of had to relocate that to downtown. But yet you incorporated in that environment a new gay club in downtown Sandusky. It was actually filmed at a club in Sandusky, correct?
Well, it's just, you know, movies are so complicated, you know. It's like
I mean, the exterior.
The exterior was, yeah. The exterior is the current queer bar in Sandusky called the Crow Bar.
Right. And it's so, been there about 10 years, I think, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yep. Yep.
And in the, when you look at the interior shots of the Universal Fruit and Nut Company for that last night, you actually have some significant people from the history of Sandusky's gay bars in the movie.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So, you know, that when Udo was sitting at the bar talking to the young gay bartender, I had asked Harvey Hayes, who owned, I want to at some point, like, give you all the names of all the queer bars that I know of in town from in a second. But he started the a club called Club X or Eccentricities. And that was big in the 90s and maybe early 2000s. So Harvey was always, and he was one of Mr. Pat's best friends, you know, so part of that family that I'm talking about. So, you know, when Udo, when Mr. Pat character is looking around, kind of like trying to get somebody to recognize him, he sort of waves and whistles to Harvey, and Harvey like gives him the brush, which like cracks me up every time. But that's Harvey Hayes, one of the gay pioneers of our town. And then on the right side, sitting in the back, is Tim Allison and Michael Sellers, who were the ones that not only started the Keg, which is the first queer bar, but then also started later the Fruit and Nut. And they're sitting there kind of at a table together. And Tim has subsequently passed away, unfortunately. So I kind of dedicated the film to him and, you know, amongst other folks. But they're like gay royalty, you know, in my town, and people that always had the courage to be themselves and openly, you know, and they're the ones that changed the world, you know. So, yeah, I wanted to pay my respects to my elders.
And that's, you know, that's something that right now might not mean much to some people, but going forward, it's like when you go back and look at old home movies or whatever, and you have someone memorialized in there, whether it's a, you know, an elderly relative or an old family home that doesn't exist anymore. It just kind of gives you a warm feeling. And it's the same with that. I mean, you could have put anybody in there. You could have had random old people sitting in the back of the bar, but you chose to use people that were actually, you know, important to the story itself. And, you know, of course, Mr. Pat had passed away before the movie, but I think it's somewhat important to maybe spend a minute explaining who Mr. Pat was and what impact he had on the gay scene in Sandusky, because we're talking about somebody, this is not somebody from 2010 that was a little eccentric. We're talking about somebody going back to the 70s or 80s that was wildly recognizable in a small town halfway between Toledo and Detroit.
Toledo and Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a time when these people didn't exist really, even in bigger towns. But Mr. Pat was an important part of your inspiration for the Swan Song, obviously. What was it like as a teenager seeing him around town?
Well, I mean, it was like you were spotting like a rock star, you know, like because everybody almost seemed to dress in all the same color palette, and it was a pretty conservative place, you know, for the, back then.
Earth tones and plaids.
What's that? Earth tones. Yeah. I mean, there was, you know, I mean, I'm an 80s child. And so there was a number of us that were rebelled against all that. And, you know, were like wore crazy colors or, you know, crazy hair and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, people looked pretty normal or boring. Well, I'm sorry, whatever, whatever you want to call it. But Pat, not Pat, you know, Pat, I remember being a little, I lived, you know, not far from downtown, and I would ride my bike downtown. And every once in a while I would see this very mysterious creature, you know, walking around, you know, smoking a cigarette. And I couldn't tell if it was like a man's suit or a woman's pantsuit. you know, and like women's cocktail rings on his fingers and smoking like a Moore cigarette and like a scarf, and a hat, you know, like a fedora. And so I just was very fascinated by this person who looked completely different. And I sort of innately knew was queer, you know, and, even as like a pre-queer, you know, a budding queer boy, little boy. So I always was like fascinated with him. And, years later, you know, when I didn't show this in Edge of 17, but I originally wrote it this way, that, you know, the first time I went to the Fruit and Nut, you know, when I walked in, I saw somebody dancing and sparkling and being fabulous. And I turned and there was this man that I had seen, you know, since I was a kid. And so I knew that I was home, you know, because there he was. And for various different reasons, Mr. Pat was written as one of the main characters of Edge of 17, interestingly enough, but we could not find the right actor to play him, you know, and do him justice. So Leah Delaria originally had a smaller part, and we folded all of Mr. Pat's scenes into, they became Angie scenes. Angie was played by Leah. So, but yeah, you know, I saw him. I never really knew Mr. Pat. That's the weird thing. Like our lives kept crossing paths. When I wrote Edge of 17, I went home on a research trip to talk to him, you know, because I only vaguely knew him growing up because I left there when I was 18, you know. But when I went back to interview him, he had just had an aneurysm. And I remember bringing a dozen flowers to his hospital room and he was unconscious. And, but I did talk to David, his lover, as they called it in those days, my lover. And David showed me all around the house and, you know, they had shag carpeting that was like that. Uh-huh. I swear to God, it was like that. And, you know, oil paintings of their poodles and, you know, it's like Liberace, you know, Liberace on acid kind of thing. And it was amazing. And actually when Udo goes back to look for his old house, you know, in the movie and it realizes it's been torn down, we actually filmed on the actual site of Pat and David's house. What more can I say? So anyway, yeah. So I got to know a lot about Pat from David. And I remember David showed me down in the basement all of Pat's gowns, you know, that he had made over the years. Cause he was like a hairdresser by day and a brilliant drag queen performer, by night. And, made all of his own costumes kind of was like a comedy queen, very inspired by Carol Burnett and that kind of thing. And years later, I saw Pat perform. No, it was not years later. It was like before that, because that was before he had the aneurysm that I saw him perform. But years after I had moved away, one time I went back to the bar, which was called something else then. And they said, you know, and now there was like a AIDS benefit for the Agape House, which is this house like in town that, you know, where people who were dying basically could go to live. They've been, you know, disowned and stuff like that. But anyway, there was a benefit for the Agape House. And they said, and now the return of, you know, the long-awaited return of Mr. Pat, and I almost shit my pants, you know. And so I proceeded to see the best drag show performance that I've ever seen in my life. And so I just became obsessed with this person. I was like, you know what I mean? He was like part of my DNA, and he was like kind of like my muse. So I was devastated when we cut the part out of Edge of 17, but I always knew in the back of my mind that I would get my revenge and have like a whole movie dedicated to Mr. Pat.
And so, you know, in retrospect, I think having seen the movies, it's probably a good thing it wasn't in Edge of 17 because, well, first of all, you wouldn't have the continuity because you'd have two different actors playing it then and now. But more importantly, I don't know that at that time, when Edge of 17 came out, that the world was ready for an eccentric, flamboyant, effeminate, crazy guy in small town Ohio to be a big part of a movie. I mean, you had wholesome, young, high school kids in there that a lot of people could relate to. A lot of people who were going to see the movie either had recently experienced that in their last 10 or 20 years or were in that phase right then and could relate to the characters much better. Whereas now, I think we've kind of embraced that whole spectrum of, you know, it's not just gay is not just, you know, this, it's much broader.
Right. Yes.
So I think it's fortunate that you probably didn't, you know, did have to cut it out of the first one and focus on it in Swan Song.
Yeah. I mean, everything works out in its own time and for a reason and stuff. So I agree, you know, and there had it existed in Edge of 17, there probably would be no Swan Song. So yeah, everything in its time.
And it touches on a very, very current topic, which you couldn't possibly have known when you were writing the script for it, I don't think, that in the last year and a half, so many gay bars have folded, some that have been around for 20, 30, 40 years. And because of COVID and because of changes in society and a lot of other factors, gentrification of neighborhoods have all kind of gone by the wayside. And you brought that out in a film that was that came out and started hitting the circuit and being available online right at the time that we were starting to go back to the bar scene after COVID. In different parts of the country, bars were opening up. A lot of people had a longing to go back and experience exactly what Mr. Pat experiences in that movie, which I know you could not have known when you were writing the movie because you didn't know that COVID was going to come along and knock everything out.
No, and exactly. And it's interesting. There were, you know, we were, the movie premiered online at the South by Southwest Film Festival, which was unfortunate because you really want to see your movie with an audience, you know, but, but I've gotten the opportunities since then to do so. But there's a scene in the movie where, you know, that song comes on in the bar and it's everybody's song and they all run to the dance floor and dance. And it was my first choice of song, which is called Dancing on My Own by Robin, who's like goddess to me and to a lot of people. But you know, they're dancing and it's just that moment when everybody's together and that thing that happens, you know, like when a collective group of strangers like connects and bonds and I've had people tell me that they started crying when they watched the movie during that scene. And I said, wow, why? And they said, because they missed that, you know? And Pat even says while he's dancing, I didn't realize how much I missed this. And the drag queen that he's dancing with said, what, music, dancing? And he says, our people, you know? So, it's just like, I don't know that, and that's moved a lot of people, especially in light of the movie coming out at a time when people weren't able to be together and still aren't completely now with this.
Yeah. It's hit or miss depending on, you know, whether you live in a red or blue state.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, a lot of different things. I personally was kind of relieved to know that at least a couple of new adventures have come on the scene. And you live in New York City now, or in New York. And I interviewed a guy a couple of months ago who just opened, from what I've heard, a fabulous new club right on the edge of Hell's Kitchen in Times Square called Q. Mm-hmm. And a 4-story bar with a cabaret, a cruising bar, a 3,000 square foot dance floor with all kinds of lights and sound equipment on the top floor. And so that kind of gives me a little hope for the future that Swan Song maybe isn't really the swan song for the gay community, that maybe it's going to give enough people a realization that, hey, this is kind of circling the drain and we need some fresh blood in here to bring something fresh and to revive our community, even if it's not exactly cookie cutter of what we had 20 years ago or 40 years ago. Q, as you mentioned with in a conversation with me about Universal Fruit and Nut, back in those days, a lot of bars were segmented. In bigger cities that had multiple bars, very frequently, a bar would have its own distinct clientele. It would be a white male preppy bar, or it will be a Hispanic country western bar, or it would be a leather Levi bar. They all had their own kind of niche. But in smaller towns like Sandusky, Universal Fruit and Nut was a melting pot. It was people from all different walks of life, male and female, macho, drag queen, whatever. And they were all kind of partying together because that was the community. And when I was talking to Frankie Sharp about the Q, I get the impression that that's the direction they're trying to go in with their bar. He confirmed with me that the letter Q, the name of the club, was inspired by the word queer, and it embraces everybody. He is of Asian heritage. He's got partners that are Italian and Black and white and whatever, different walks of life, different histories, and they're all kind of drawn together in this one facility, which I hope is the route that we're going to see coming, you know, going forward, that we're going to see a resurgence of that and maybe a little bit more extravagant queer community.
I would love that myself. And I haven't been there yet, but I'm going to definitely go check it out. But yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, the Universal Fruit and Nut Company, the name is like, that philosophy was like baked into the name. It really was. You know, that's what was so amazing about it. It was like the Shangri-La of like everybody, of diversity. And when I went to New York and moved there in 85, I was pretty surprised to see, as you just said, that everything was so specialized in a way that, you know, if you were different, you weren't necessarily accepted if you weren't part of that segment or whatever. And that's what I loved about places like the Fruit and Nut, is like everyone was accepted. Yeah, the Q sounds, yeah. I love that word queer. It's like perfect. It's just perfect to describe myself. And so, you know, like it encapsulates so all of us, really.
I agree. And yeah. To me, you know, of course I came out, my first gay bar experience was in 78, so about 5-6 years before you. And and at that time, everything was gay. I mean, lesbians were gay.
Yes.
You know, it was gay. That's it.
Yeah.
And from my perspective and the way I grew up with, you know, the terminology and the community and everything else, this transference to LGBTQIA+ is more divisive than it is inclusive, because it's, then you have to pick which part of that community you are. You know, are you the L? Are you the Q? Are you the T? And gay and queer both have that same kind of vibe to me. So I have to agree with you. I think queer is a much better word, and it can be all inclusive. It's basically, you know, saying we're unconventional in some way, but not specifying, well, you know, I was born a male, but I identify as a female, or I, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're not trying to separate ourselves. We're not trying to be, you know, a bunch of smaller groups. We're trying to be one big group.
Right. It's a word that brings us all together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I hope they have the, you know, the greatest success there. And I felt the same way when you mentioned the name of the Universal Fruit and Nut Company. When I first saw the movie, I was just like, oh my God, that's such a great name for a gay bar. And I did not know until many years later, until probably a few months ago, that it was an actual bar in Sandusky. I thought it was something you made up for the movie. And I was so relieved to know that it actually did exist and to see it also memorialized again in Swan Song, even though you stretch the truth a little bit. It didn't actually exist for 40 years. It existed right. for like 3 or 4 years, I think. But still, you know, the message is there and the sincerity is there. And making movies is about telling stories. It's not necessarily about being 100% factual. Then they'd be yeah. called documentaries.
Exactly. and we've always had, you know, even though The Fruit and Nut didn't last forever, you know, we've all these years we've had, I remember the name of that bar downtown that was like the unofficial gay bar. It's called the Rieger Hotel. And then there was The Keg and The Keg 2 and Raiders and Your Place or Mine and Club X and The Fruit and Nut. And I got the order fucked up. But anyway, and then Crowbar. I mean, so there's been like 7 or 8 or 9 incarnations of the same concept, basically, you know, that really has. But now the Crowbar, you know, it's not gay owned anymore. That was a change that happened. It still has drag performances, but it's more like straight people.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't, you know, so that's so I don't know. Maybe that can reboot in some way or not. Straight people are great. And that's like, you know, there's a lot of straight people that consider themselves queer too in a different way, you know, but different, you know, but I don't know. It's like the community itself is the queer community is kind of dissolved a bit. So yeah, that's the thing. In some small way with my film, if I, in a small way, sparked a conversation on that, I'm very happy.
Well, I think you probably have. So what is next? There's got to be something else in the back of your head that
yeah.
this is going to be the next project. What are you going to tackle?
I've always wanted to do a TV show called Flamingos, which is about a gay retirement home in Florida. and kind of like Golden Girls meets the White Lotus kind of thing. And so that's what I'm working on now. I'm like creating a pitch for it that I'm going to go out and try to sell soon. So, you know, we'll see where it goes, but still exploring a lot of the same thing, you know, concepts and still exploring queer life. So, and it won't just be about the older residents, but also about the people that work there. And so we'll see. Hopefully I can get it made, you know. So it's hard to get things done in this world, but you just can't give up.
Well, I certainly hope so, because the contribution you've made already has been just, you know, very enlightening and very entertaining. It's something that, you know, when I saw Edge of 17, I would never think 20 or 25 years later there would be such a collection of movies that, you know, really delve into the gay scene as much as there are. And yeah. you have certainly made a large contribution to that collection of films.
Thank you. I'm very proud to have you say that. Thank you.
Are you quite welcome. We appreciate you helping, you know, document our history and bringing out some of the stories to the world and, you know, kind of starting some of these conversations so that we can continue to, you know, memorialize the places that were so important to us. My whole project was started because of memories of one of my favorite gay bars that I first encountered in 1983, which was called Backstreet in Atlanta. And 2020 was the 45th anniversary of them opening. They were not in business at that time. They had been closed for about 10 years, but they made such a big impact on the community. When I started talking about Backstreet and my conversations with the people who owned it, it kind of snowballed into talking about other bars from the past, from Atlanta and other cities I lived in and other cities my friends lived in. And once COVID hit, I just really started digging into it and said, where are all these bars that, you know, used to exist around the country? And like I said, I'm up to over 1,500 now. And the stories keep coming. And so
can you make like, I love what you're doing so much. I mean, can you, maybe you should, well, not, I'm not telling you what to do, but I would love to see like a book of this. Has anybody done that? Like,
not really. And I am working on it. The problem with the book, as you know, with the movie is that when you're dealing with 1,500 points of interest,
yes,
you only have so many seconds you can spend on each one. So you can't do a comprehensive, unless I wanted to do an encyclopedia of gay bars, which would take a very long time to write. But what I'm planning on doing is I've been focusing on one aspect at a time and reaching out to the people who have the important stories to tell. And I think the first book will be about the mega clubs, the discos, you know, the big places that everybody can relate to. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows that in New York City, there was a Limelight and the Saint, and there was also a Limelight in Atlanta. And there was, you know, all these, the Copa in Fort Lauderdale and Circus and Studio One in LA and all these big bars that had a, you know, a big impact on their communities. And so I'm working on something on that, but ultimately, yes, I would like to be able to do as many as possible and hope that somebody will pick up the ball and continue doing it after I'm gone, because I'm not going to live forever. So,
yes.
And it could take forever to do this project.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, someone will, you'll pass the torch to someone. Yeah. But I love how you talked about collecting the different logos of all the bars, even just like a book with all the logos in it. Although I don't know if you could fit 1,500, but that would be cool to, you know, it's like a coffee table book or something as an inspiration for conversation or whatever. I don't know. I
love it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
If you go to my website on the homepage of GabeArchives.com, there's a video slideshow there right on the main page that I created using about 1,250 logos of gay bars, each on the screen for 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing is probably 20 minutes long.
Mm.
But if you just sit there, you just see the different graphic images kind of flashing before your eyes. And then I've also just released a separate video that's shorter, with about 225 bars from Atlanta's gay history, because Atlanta Pride is coming up in the beginning of October. So,
and there have been 225 bars there over the years
that I have been able to document and most of them find logos for, some other friends of mine who are also doing some research in the Chicago area sent me a list that they've compiled of over 700 gay bars that used to exist in Chicago.
Wow. Wow.
So, but many of them, they have very sketchy information. Like it was near Halstead, or it might've been open in, you know, December of 1967.
But if you guys don't, document this, it's a certain point, it will be as if it never existed. Right. You know what I mean? That's why it's so important, you know, that we know our history.
And that's why it's so important to me to have people like you share your portion of it so that there's more of that information out there. And it's just not me typing up a paragraph and saying this bar used to be here, but people are getting a personal sense of, you know, what it meant to somebody and what impact it had on the past.
Yeah. Well, so for me, it changed my life. It saved my life. And it's where I met my husband. I'm still with. So,
it gave you the husband that you've had for all these years and kind of cemented you in a career that really embraces our history. And we really appreciate that. You've done an excellent job with it.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm honored. Thank you.
And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at GabeArchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.